This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. Kemper Donovan, welcome to Better Reading.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Do you know, I talk to so many people. I actually think I've recorded well over 500 podcasts now. So that would be 500 authors. And there is always something different. And there is always something really intriguing. And it's the same with you.
So I'm glad there is. What if you had said, but in this case,
nothing.
This is a bit boring. I've seen this before.
No, I haven't actually. All right. So Kemper is a graduate of Stanford University and Harvard Law School. Kemper worked at the literary management company called Circle of Confusion for a decade before transitioning to writing full time. He is the host of All About Agatha, a highly successful podcast dedicated to the queen of crime, Agatha Christie. That's where I'm saying it's interesting. And it's also the inspiration behind his latest novel, The Busy Body, the first book in the Ghostwriter series. Okay. Firstly, I need to understand the podcast and tell me how many people are interested in that topic.
There are a lot of people interested in the topic of Agatha Christie. I would call it a successful niche podcast because there are Agatha Christie fanatics scattered around the world. So the podcast is listened to on every continent, I guess maybe not Antarctica, but every inhabited continent. And it's been a joy to do the podcast since 2016. The story of the podcast is a little bit of a long and torturous one, so I'll make it as simple as possible because the podcast really was a joint effort. Yes. I started it with a dear friend of mine who I'd known for many years before we even started the podcast, and she was a lover of literature and mystery, and her name is Catherine Brobeck. So for the first 5 years of the podcast, we hosted it together, and it was very conversational, like this podcast, in fact. Mm-hmm. And we, the backbone of the podcast, the sort of organizing principle of it was that we were going to rank all 66 of Agatha Christie's full-length novels, which is quite a task to take on. And we had gotten to novel number 60 when Catherine tragically passed away unexpectedly.
Oh,
this happened.
How terrible.
Yeah, this happened at the end of 2021. Oh, and
I'm sorry.
It's really, thank you. It was obviously a tragedy and, you know, something I'm still mourning and recovering from, as well as all of her loved ones, her friends and family. In the wake of it, though, you know, over those 5 years, we had built such a community and so many friends and also fellow scholars of Agatha Christie that I was able to draw on them to be my co-hosts for the final six novels. So we did finish that ranking project. And the podcast just continues because there's always something new in the world of Agatha Christie. There's always something to talk about, something happening, a new continuation novel, a new adaptation, a new critical approach, a new biography. I worried that I wouldn't be able to continue the podcast, but I have long since stopped worrying about that because the material is pretty much endless. And as you can probably tell, I'm a fanatic and obsessive when it comes to Agatha Christie. So that is the podcast.
Okay. I'm going to go backwards, right? Because the second thing I want to talk about is you having worked in a literary management company. Now, I worked in publishing for a long time, like 30, 40 years. And I know editors, I know publishers, I know publicists, blah, blah, blah. So what I have noticed, and only in Australia, it could be different in the US, that not a lot of editors become authors, right? Not a lot of literary agents become authors. There's one or two I know, but not a lot. So do you know why I think that is? Is because they see the challenges of writing. An editor sees the challenges. A literary agent sees the challenges of writing. They see how hard it is, one, to actually, you know, even write the book, two, to get it out there, and three, to get people interested. I mean, there's so much to it, as you know. So yes. I would have thought that working for as an agent would actually quell your desire to write.
Well, listeners can't see, but I was nodding my head vigorously as you were saying all that, because I completely agree. And it's funny, I endorse your point, because I was working in the film and television industry specifically. So right. I was working as a manager for mainly film at that point. Now, right. you know, TV is the more robust yeah. Kind of avenue. But when I was doing it, it was more film than TV. So I knew how the sausage was made, so to speak, when it came to film. And there was no way that I was going to sit down and write a screenplay. I had designs of writing a screenplay before I became a manager. And that's sort of how I fell into that career, which was a lovely career. But it had an end point for me when I didn't feel creatively fulfilled anymore. And it was only by turning to books, which were my original love, as they are for so many people, but it was only by turning to books, which was outside of what I was doing in a representational capacity, that I was able to engage creatively. Mm. So you're absolutely right. If I had tried to do the thing that I had been doing as a manager, it would have been difficult. People have done it, and I applaud them for doing it, but I wouldn't have been able to do that. So for me, it was going back almost to my original love and the thing that I had only ever engaged in as a reader and as a person, but not as a career.
And so I'll go back before that, but I just want to make a comment about you wanting to write a screenplay and you've written fiction instead. I haven't read many screenplays, but when I do, I can't work out what's happening because there are so few words. And maybe it's because I'm used to reading fiction. I really find it amazing. Like, it's like a miracle how you get from a screenplay to an actual story on TV or in film. And how many words is a screenplay usually? It's about a tenth of the size of a fiction book.
I suppose it is. I mean, though, well, usually people, the rule of thumb is one page per minute. So right. if you're writing, say, a 60-minute TV right. script, it would be 60 pages or 120 pages for a feature film. That's approximately 2 hours. But right. I don't know how many pages, given the font, which is always Courier 12-point font. It's very specific. I'm actually not sure. I know for regular prose, you have approximately 300 words per page. My guess is it's significantly less in a screenplay. But yeah, screenplays are just totally different. It's a different beast because it's not a finished product. You're writing something that then has to be produced and that so many other people have to collaborate on to actually bring to life. And there's great beauty in that also. My husband actually he writes for TV, and I get very jealous of him because he collaborates so much. He collaborates with producers and other television writers, and he's constantly talking to people or in rooms with people all day, whereas I'm sitting alone in front of my laptop. But then he is jealous of me for that exact reason, because he's sick of having to collaborate. So, you know, a balance is probably best, but it's just a very different form of writing, just a totally
and
different.
And did you think genre. That's what you wanted to write? Like, at what point did you decide you wanted to write a book rather than writing screenplays?
I did originally think that I wanted to be a screenwriter, and that's why I sort of came out to Los Angeles, as so many people do, the dream factory that swallows you up and spits you back out. And but no, it actually was a great experience. What happened is that I was a manager. And my first client wrote a screenplay on spec that he sent to me, and it was called Hannah. And this is a movie that actually got made. Joe Wright directed it. Saoirse Ronan is the star. Oh, she right. she plays sort of like a almost like tween, a 12-year-old or somewhere in there, assassin. It's a fantastic movie. And when the movie came out and the credits rolled and I was sitting in the theater, and I said, wow, that was about the best as an experience can get for a manager, I realized that it wasn't enough and that I didn't feel like I had enough of a connection to the finished product as a manager of the screenplay that got turned into the movie years later, and that I couldn't do this for 30 to 40 years, that I wouldn't feel fulfilled. So that was the point at which I said, okay, well, maybe I need to figure this out. And then it took years. I mean, it took years to write my first book and figure out what I wanted to say and who I wanted to be and all that stuff.
Okay, so I want to go back to where you grew up and your education and how you got to where you are. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in the suburbs of New York. In the States, we call it the tri-state area. It's New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. It's sort of like a suburban hub of the city. And I grew up very much in that area, in the suburbs, in the burbs, not in the city. And I went to my undergrad at Stanford in Northern California, which was great. I went at a very specific time, which was when the dot-com bubble was first happening, which is dating me, but I graduated in 2001. So that was a very exciting time to be there. But if you were someone who basically just wanted to read Jane Eyre and talk about, you know, Jane Eyre and the Brontes and other Victorian literature, it wasn't exactly a perfect fit, but I had a great time there. But I graduated not really knowing what I wanted to do. So
have at the time, did you think that maybe you wanted to be a writer of sorts? No.
And I've always said that if I ever got out onto the other side of having anyone such as you ever be interested enough in me to ask, that I would be 100% honest about this, because I feel like so few people ever answer this way. I always felt, as a struggling would-be writer, 99.99999% of people, when they're asked, well, when did you know you wanted to be a writer? They say, from when I was four, or from when I was 8 years old, and I always knew that I wanted to be a writer. That was not the case for me. I never wanted to be a writer. I was always a very passionate reader of almost any genre, especially mysteries and Victorian literature. But I never wanted to be a writer. And that continued on until that moment when Hannah, when the credits were rolling for Hannah. And I wasn't thinking, oh, I got to write that novel that I've been passionate about. More, I was just thinking, I need to do something that's going to fulfill me creatively. So I need to figure that out. And that happened when I was about 30.
Yeah.
Well, so it wasn't until I was about 30 that I knew that I wanted to, started the process of becoming a writer.
Mm. So you went to Harvard Law School. Were you thinking you're going to be a lawyer? Is that why you were there?
No, I was more thinking. I was more thinking, but much to my parents' chagrin, I was more thinking that I didn't know what I wanted to do, and I wasn't really ready to be out in the world. The fuller and real answer also is that I did not come out as being gay until I was about 25 years old. I was just a late bloomer in that way. And I think it set me back a couple of years, not in a bad way, but just in that I needed a bit more schooling, a bit more time in the collegiate bubble. So it's almost as if I extended my university time that way. And I had the privilege to be able to do that. Many people would not have been able to do that. And I was able to do that with my parents' help. So I'm very appreciative of that. And some of my very best friends I actually made in law school. It was almost as if those were my formative years, because I think of the personal growth that I had to do there. So this is all very a story of a late bloomer.
I'm liking it. Do you know, and I've only thought about this now, there are a lot of authors that I speak to that studied law, you know, and some even practiced for some years and then came to writing. But I don't meet any other linear occupations, well, not often, where doctors, for instance, have come to writing. I don't get the same kind of amount of that. I think law would be the most popular from law to writing.
I think that's true. I think there's a personality type that goes into law that can sort of go into the writing bucket. There are a lot of people that go to law school that, you know, definitely would not become writers. But I think there is a type that does. And also, I say this all the time, law school made me such a better writer. I mean, law school is a lot about writing, actually. It's not necessarily creative writing, but it is how to write efficiently, how to write persuasively. I mean, those are all skills that I draw on in my novel writing, 100%. And you're just constantly writing in law school. At least I was in my law school. So it was, I'm retired. I'm a retired lawyer in the state of New York, and I never really practiced a day. I passed the bar and then got sworn in and immediately retired. but I actually do use a lot of what I learned in law school.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Does it give you comfort? Like, let's say, you know, your novel came out and it bombed. Would that be something you would draw on, or you just...
Oh, yes. No, yes, yes. I mean, it has given me comfort for many years now to think that
it's like
I could draw on it. Absolutely.
Policy. Yeah, it's an insurance
Absolutely.
Policy. Yeah. Okay, so what came first, the writing or the podcast? The writing of the novel?
The podcast came before The Busy Buddy. So I published one novel before the podcast, which is called The Decent Proposal.
Right.
And it was published by HarperCollins in the US. I'm not sure if or how it came out in Australia, to be perfectly honest with you, but it's not a mystery. It's a suspense novel. It's sort of adult contemporary, has a love story in it, but also some suspense. But I would never call it a mystery. It certainly was not marketed as a mystery. And that did okay. And then I had the very cliched issue of the sophomore novel where I was, you know, banging my head against a wall, a laptop, whatever, and not really coming up with something that was working for me. And this went on for quite a while, actually. Mm-hmm. And it was during that time that I started the podcast with Catherine, with my friend. And a couple of years into the podcast, it still took me years to have this epiphany. I realized if I'm not sick of talking about and reading Agatha Christie for literally hours per week, I mean, I was devoting hours upon hours a week to this, especially in the beginning. It's very hard to launch a podcast, as I'm sure as you know. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of it's a steep learning curve. Mm-hmm. And you got to really love what you're talking about, or else you're just going to give up on it very quickly. And I realized, why am I not writing a mystery? This is absurd that I'm not writing a mystery. And once I realized that, it's not like it was easy. It's never easy. At least for me, writing is never easy. I'm not going to pretend that it was effortless, but it clicked. It clicked. And I was like, oh, this is what I should be writing. And The Busy Body is the result of that.
Okay. So then another part of me says that you've got all this knowledge around writing and Agatha Christie and master writer, master storyteller, and now you're going to have a go. Does that make you feel, well, did it make you feel like, you know, can I do it?
I think I revere Agatha Christie so much as a writer, as a genius.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's something that I say as much as possible, because there's still so many people who do not give Agatha Christie her due, who are like, yeah, but you don't really think she's a good writer, do you? And I'm like, no, I think she's one of the best writers ever. I think that's why she has sold over 2 billion books. And I think she was a genius. I hold her in such high esteem that it's not even close. I can never come up to her, nor am I even trying. I'm trying to do my own thing, but also very much drawing on some of the tropes and the tricks that I analyzed and, you know, delighted in the course of the podcast. So it is in homage to Christie, but I'm not even going to pretend that I'm writing something as effortlessly enjoyable and brilliant as the bulk of her output was. And not to mention the fact that she wrote as much as she did too. I mean, that's the other thing. She wrote brilliantly, but she also wrote a lot. And I'm just, the more writing that I do, and in particular, the more mystery writing, since this is, as you mentioned, the first in a series, the more I am in awe of her actually, and realize how difficult it was, what she actually did year in, year out for over half a century.
Okay, because I've never interviewed Agatha Christie, she hasn't been on this podcast. Tell me, because I speak to a lot of people where I read a book and the sentence, you know, I'm in love with the sentence or I'm in love with the paragraph, and I often think, oh, gosh, and that just came out of the author's mouth just like that because it reads so, you know, beautifully and I'm not looking at mm-hmm. the technique or the craft. Was she that kind of writer? You know, was she rewriting sentences, paragraphs? Do you know that? Or was she somebody that just sat down, wrote, and then moved on to the next one?
She, at the height of her powers, she wrote incredibly quickly.
Right.
She was very, very efficient. I mean, she wrote so much. It's actually very difficult. We obviously know when her books were published, and they tended to be published once a year, although in the 30s and 40s, it was more like twice a year. There was 1 year where I think it was three in a year.
Wow.
But she was writing so quickly that she actually just had a queue of novels waiting to be published. So it's tricky knowing exactly how quickly she wrote and how she wrote too, because she did not like to talk about it very much. You know, she was born in 1890, so she was born in Victorian times. She grew up in Edwardian times, so she had that sort of Edwardian reticence, especially as a woman, where she did not want to toot her own horn. So she barely ever talked about her craft and almost acted as though it just happened, which is nonsense. Of course it didn't. Even in her autobiography, I mean, she wrote an autobiography that's over 500 pages long, and she barely talks about her writing process in it. Wow. She talks a whole lot about her childhood, and, you know, it's a great book, but it's frustrating in that regard. So we don't know a whole lot, or at least we don't know as much as I wish we did about how she wrote, but we do know that she certainly did revise. She interestingly changed the way that she wrote initially as she got older, because she started using a dictaphone more. So she started actually speaking into a dictaphone, which some people believe made some of her later novels wordier than her earlier ones. But even with those novels, she would go back and you know, they would be transcribed and she would revise them. I think that the finished product, especially in the best Agatha Christie's, is effortless. And the thing that she does better than almost anyone in any genre is to create a readable, propulsive story. Mm-hmm. And that is just such a quality that's easily dismissed, because I think you read it and you say, oh, it goes down so easy. This is so easy. So it can't be good because it's not complicated. And it's like, well, no, it's good and it's brilliant because it's easy. And I mean, T.S. Eliot talked about the joy of reading an Agatha Christie in the bath. I mean, these are books that are meant to be enjoyed, but that doesn't mean that they're not good or interesting or complex or masterful. And it frustrates me that people misapprehend that to this day. Yeah.
You probably know this is snobbery about, you know, what's commercial fiction, what's literary fiction.
Yes.
But anyway, that's another podcast. I just want to ask one more question about Agatha, and then I want to get to the busybody. Did she have the same editor? Do you know? Did she work with the same publishers?
She had one publisher for her first five novels, and then she actually jumped to Collins. So she was with William Collins, Billy. Billy Collins was her editor. She had the same agent once she made that jump as well. So basically for her entire career, she was with the same publisher and agent, and also the same U.S. publisher as well. So it was what eventually became HarperCollins and Dodd Mead in the U.S. And yes, I mean, there was great consistency there, which is not something that is all that common nowadays. Mm. I mean, the idea of a writer sticking with the same publisher from, I believe, 1926 until 1976. I mean, that is when the last of her novels, very, very rare. And her letters are very entertaining. I mean, she was not shy about telling her opinion about covers and just the, you know, there are so many little ins and outs of the publishing process when you're getting into the nitty gritty. And
tell me about your process to getting The Busybody published. Firstly, how did you approach the writing process? Were you, you know, a 9-to-5-er? Were you writing linear? What is it they say? Are you a pantser or a forgotten what the other one was? Have you heard that term?
I haven't, no, but I can tell that I want to.
Well, I think there's two
is it like pantser pajamas or something like that?
No, pants.
Trousers, I should say.
No, I think a pantser means that it's by the seat of your pants. Like you just.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
You get in there. You're not that organized. You're not planning out. You don't have a whiteboard of where the characters are going. It's more just sitting down and writing. So which one are you?
Do pants in Australia mean underpants like they do in the UK? Or is it? Yes. They do. Okay. Yeah. They no, do. That's a constant source of confusion between the US.
Yeah. Well, they also mean pants as well. So we've taken.
Oh, they can mean pants sometimes. Oh, okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, trousers. Yep. But what are you? What's your style? Do you think?
You know, my process for the busybody it was definitely more efficient. So I'll just talk about that. I had an idea of what I wanted to do, and I wrote it for me relatively quickly. My first novel, again, when I was just figuring out what kind of a writer I even wanted to be, that took years. And it was like a little bit here, a little bit there, and I had a full-time job at the same time. So this, though, you know, I was doing the podcast, but by the time I was writing The Busybody, I did not have a full-time job. So I really was able to devote at least my minimum is 4 hours a day. You know, 4 hours of actual writing, which often translates into taking up 6 to 8 hours, you know, of sitting in front of your desk.
Because you've got to tidy your desk twice a day.
You've got to tidy your desk. You've got to check your email. You've got to go to your favorite website.
Yeah, you know.
I have two children. The children are also, the Busybody was written when my oldest was quite young. So she was also taking up a lot of my time. But yeah, I would say a minimum of 4 hours a day. And generally after that, it tends to be diminishing returns. That's about as much as I can handle in a day.
Mm-hmm. And do you apply word count to that or just leave it as is?
I usually do. I try to, I've just finished a draft of the book after The Busybody because I have a second one that's coming out that will be coming out in a year. And for that one, I did 500 good words a day, which is if you can do 500 good words, true words that will probably make it into the real draft of the novel. That's, I think, you move along at a pretty nice clip. Actually. Mm-hmm. So five more than that, though. And then I start doing what I call like 1,000 garbage words a day. And then that's mm-hmm. where you're just sort of it becomes gobbledygook or you're describing things rather than actually writing. And that frustrates me because then you start living in that murkiness rather than feeling like you're writing a book. So 500 words a day. Yeah.
And so do you think the greatest influence for The Busybody is Agatha Christie? Is that how?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the easy answer, but and the obvious answer, but it's the true answer. It's definitely Agatha Christie. I didn't, though. I never tried to imitate her prose style. And that's also what I mean, because she had this sort of this effervescence and this ease and lightness. Not in all of her books, but in her best books, at least in my opinion. And my prose style is a bit more involved. It's a bit heavier. So yes, Agatha Christie was my biggest influence. But I think the fact that I have read as widely as I have in the mystery genre overall gave me the confidence to say, well, let me take from Agatha Christie what I think I can take, which is some of the concepts, some of the, again, the tricks or the tropes that she used and put those in my book in sort of a classic puzzle mystery sort of a way. But I'm not going to worry about or try to sound like her because, you know, look at Dorothy Sayers. Dorothy Sayers is a beloved queen of crime as well. And her writing style could not be more different from Agatha Christie. So that kind of freed me. The fact that I was a fan of Christie, but also had read widely within mystery. Mm-hmm.
And also to, you know, to sit down and copy an actual writing style is kind of dead end. I mean,
It never works. I made reference to this on an episode recently, actually, of my podcast, but Ernest Hemingway has a great quote about that, where he says, like, it's just not good. it's a dead end. Like you said, you shouldn't do it because you're not, your writing's not going to be alive if you're just trying to imitate someone else's. It's
absolutely
pointless.
Do you know what else I think too? And often people say this to me because I've been in the industry so long. Oh, I've got a book that I'm writing, but I'm not going to tell anyone because they might steal the idea. And I think that for someone to steal an idea is very, very difficult. You know, one time a friend of mine, she wanted me to see what she'd written and she wanted me to sign an NDA. I'm just like, what? Because what I think, and you might disagree with this, but if I said to you, can you please write a story about the dog walking in the park? And then I wrote the story and five other people wrote the story, it would be entirely different.
Yeah.
Not just in style, in everything, because you bring to it your experience, your knowledge, your.
Yeah. It's funny. I completely agree with what you said. And I've actually had to think about that a lot, because in the film industry, when I was still a manager, as you can imagine, there are a lot more venues in which you have to share your ideas, because you have to pitch people, you have to talk to producers about, well, here's what I would do maybe if I was going to rewrite this assignment. And it's such a symptom of a newbie writer, a newbie screenwriter. So most people go through it where they say, oh, but I can't say what I would do because they'll steal the idea. And it's like, they won't. and honestly, the real sad reason is because there are no new ideas. Like they've been done. And when you actually sit down and write something, you're going to bring your unique personality and passion to it so that you will create something interesting, hopefully. But the idea, the core of the idea, like you said, the dog walking in the park or whatever it is, it's not new. It's been done millions of times at this point.
And I think for me, that's the beauty of fiction and why I get addicted to it. It's, yes, I do like storyline and I do like strong story, but I also like what comes with it, like what that author tells me. And that's why I love this podcast. You know, I hear so many fantastic stories. Anyway, we're out of time, Kemper.
Oh, I could talk to you. I could have done this. My podcast episodes are like sometimes they're like 3-4 hours long. Oh, so I'm glad that you're cutting me off, because I could just stay here all night.
Well, do you know, I'm going to go and find your podcast and I'm going to have a listen. The book is called The Busybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you'd like more information about Better Reading, follow us on Facebook or visit betterreading.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.